For a summary of all developments up to the moment, we take you first to Edward Doyce in London.
This is London. A British military observer here this morning confirmed that British and Americans had won the first round in the Battle of Tunisia. It was a small round, but nevertheless, he said, that 11 Axis tanks were knocked out before the engagement was presumably broken off. The German radio had claimed earlier this morning that the British Army had reached Tabaka, 65 miles west of Bizerta on the coast road. If this is true, it would indicate that British troops had crossed the gap in the railway line between Algiers and Tunis by means of road vehicles hauled over the mountain barrier at this point. The British observer would not state where this first clash took place. In the 8th Army's advance yesterday, north and south of Benghazi, 28 Axis tanks, 24 guns, and 250 motor vehicles were captured or destroyed between Martuba and Slanta. The Axis air activity was slight, but the RAF again bombed Tunis aerodrome, scoring hits on hangars. This morning, Soviet communique announced that in the recent three-day offensive on the Volkhov front, the Red Army inflicted 5,000 casualties on the enemy. In the Stalingrad area, German infantry and tanks broke through to the rear of Red Army units in one sector of the factory district, but the Red Army counterattacked and partly annihilated the two German companies making this advance. In the Caucasus, the Russian forces held the gains made in the past few days. Lavelle is frantically trying to consolidate his position in what the London Times this morning called a paper dictatorship of which the Germans pull the strings. Lavelle dissolved the Committee for Franco-German Relations and announced that he would appoint a new committee, presumably of outright collaborationists. An American spokesman at Allied headquarters said that General Eisenhower's staff in North Africa consists of two Americans and two British officers. The chief of staff is the American Brigadier General Walter B. Smith. The Germans boasted that their submarines had sunk 8 heavily laden freighters, 1 large tanker, and 2 destroyers out of an Allied convoy in the Atlantic. The gross weight of the 9 supply ships, including cargo, is given as 55,000 tons. A figure which somewhat detracts from the magnitude claimed for the achievement. But the U-boat menace is causing serious alarm in parliamentary circles here. And whether true or not, such German reports as I have just given are bound to intensify the pressure on the government to speed up shipbuilding, intensify offensive action, and increase the scientific means of detection. And now for the fighting front in Egypt to grant power in Cairo.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. After making a temporary stand to protect the coast road, German elements south of Benghazi withdrew from the ridge on which they had formed a screen. Perhaps they saw the futility of a barrier so easily bypassed. Perhaps they decided that what remained of their forces in the Benghazi area was not worth rocking tanks to save. British desert columns meanwhile reached the vicinity of the coast about 100 miles south of Benghazi. They continued to advance. North of Benghazi, other pursuing troops pressed toward what appears to be a virtually abandoned port. They have been slogging along the coastal road all week in what is charitably described as abominable weather. The roads have been soaked and made treacherous with collected mud. The rain has been like tropic rain in regularity, but cold and chilling. There have been frequent road barriers left by the retreating enemy. So, the seemingly slow progress of the 8th Army has, under the circumstances, been remarkably rapid. The advance has had its bright side, too. Between Martuba and Slanta, the pursuers picked up 28 tanks, 24 guns, and 250 trucks, which they either took over or destroyed. A young Royal Air Force officer who was forced down and captured in the early stages of the German retreat subsequently escaped to give a vivid description of the Nazi rout. He personally saw Marshal Erwin Rommel, an arrogant, red-faced man standing up in an open car, directing the retreat. Rommel's car drove by him 4 times, threading in and out of the traffic. There's good reason to believe that if Marshal Rommel remains in Africa, he will not attempt to stand at Agila, but instead rush his entire force into Tripoli and thence to Tunis. There he would have perhaps 30,000 men and a little equipment with which to keep apart the 2 Allied armies until reinforcements arrived. We don't think here that Rommel would get those reinforcements. But perhaps he might gamble on it. If he lost, there would always be the alternative of attempting an evacuation. It's reliably reported that among the German dead is hardy, resourceful Captain Kiel, who once built up a roving battle group with captured equipment and remained to the end one of Rommel's most trusted officers. I return you now to New York.
Next, we go halfway around the world for a report direct from the Southwest Pacific. Go ahead, Australia.
A news review by George Thomas Fenster.
This is George Thomas Fenster speaking from Australia. The suspicion that the Japs are not going to give Buna up without a tough fight seems to be borne out in the latest reports from the New Guinea sector today. The Japs have accumulated a naval force off the northern coast of New Guinea in support of Buna, their last stronghold in Papua. In spite of bad weather, our bombers went out in search of this convoy. They sank one of the enemy's light cruisers and a destroyer. Another Jap destroyer was damaged. The action took place in a daring night raid by our flying fortresses just off the Buna-Guna area in Papua. Our bombardiers took the Jap naval force entirely by surprise. They swooped in low during a rain squall and dropped 500-pound bombs on the enemy's convoy. While they were out over the sea thwarting this last attempt on the enemy's part to reinforce his land forces in New Guinea, it is reported that our allied land forces were closing the ring around the coastal strip at Buna-Guna, where the Japs are making their last stand in Papua. There is no official indication whether or not the enemy warships off the coast were attempting to land troops or evacuate their hard-pressed forces who have been falling back under the Australians' concentrated drive. There is also insignificant information to show whether or not these ships were part of the convoy described in yesterday's communique. A spokesman at General Headquarters today gave a graphic description of the attack. He said that our bombers raided the enemy convoy in the general area of Hollencup Bay. Our bombers broke the enemy cruiser's back with a direct hit amidships, and observers say that immediately a fire broke out on board, followed by heavy explosions. Later, they said the cruiser was seen to sink. A fortress accounted for the destroyer, and our boys who dropped the bomb said it was observed, quote, splitting the destroyer open, unquote. It seems certain that this convoy was endeavoring to reinforce the garrison at Buna, for the headquarters spokesman said that during the action, a number of small boats were seen between the warship and the shore. Immediately the aircraft appeared, these small boats began to swing in circles. This made it difficult for our bombardiers to determine whether they were bound for the ships or the shore, but they strafed them. According to the latest reports, it is believed that few of the nips reached the beach. This is George Thomas Fenster speaking from Australia.
For the latest developments on the Russian front, we take you next to Robert Magadoff, who reports to you from Moscow.
This is Robert Magadoff speaking from Moscow. The rout of a large German and Romanian force in the Vladikavkaz area is the first of the shattering blows which Joseph Stalin promised the enemy in his recent speech. It's the signal for intense offensive action also on other fronts in Russia. This was stated by an editorial featured on the front page of the government organ Izvestia. The Russians are determined not to give the German army the breathing spell it needs so sorely in spite of its victories this summer. The Russians are determined not to allow Hitler take advantage of the winter in order to replenish and strengthen his forces, badly battered by the remarkable resistance of the Red Army, especially at Stalingrad. This determination is particularly significant because in the Soviet conception, the forthcoming offensive action of the Red Army will run parallelly to the present efforts of their allies, which have already radically altered the situation not only in North Africa, but also in Europe, altered it in favor of the Anglo-Soviet-American coalition. Thus, the Soviet victory at Vladikavkaz is only a beginning. How was this victory achieved? The name Vladikavkaz is composed of two words. Vladi means to dominate, and Kavkaz is the Russian for the Caucasus. It's a most appropriate name, for Vladikavkaz is the key to military domination over a large part of the Caucasus. There begins the famous Georgian military highway. The Germans were hoping to reach this road, then penetrate by stages into Georgia, Armenia, and the oil republic of Azerbaijan, whose capital is Baku. At first, everything looked good for the Nazis as they swept down southeast of Nalchi. They even reached the approaches to Vladikavkaz, otherwise known as Orjonikidze. But they didn't know that in the meantime, the Russians were preparing a counter-drive. When the Germans learned about it, it was too late. The Russians struck and struck hard. They arrested the initiative and isolated a large German and Romanian force, causing havoc among it by 5 days and nights of incessant artillery and trench mortar fire. Goodbye from Moscow.
And now we take you to Kerry Longmire, reporting from the newsroom in Washington.
As far as Washington opinion is concerned, all bets are now settled as to when and where the greatest naval battle in history occurred. It was the engagement last week between our fleet and a huge Japanese armada off the Solomons, a fight that ended in the most disastrous defeat in modern history, a defeat for the Japs, of course. That beating was a far worse licking than the one handed the Germans at Jutland in the World War. Our Navy discloses that the Jap losses last week off the Solomons probably total now 28 ships destroyed and 10 more damaged. The new announcement added 5 more Japanese ships sunk and 3 others damaged, added them, that is, to the list originally announced. Thus, the setback is now believed to have cost Tokyo 2 battleships, 6 heavy cruisers, 2 light cruisers, 6 destroyers, and 12 transports. The defeat becomes even more crushing with news that Allied bombers have sunk another cruiser and a destroyer off New Guinea. That happened last night. The Navy does have a word of caution. The report of the new damage off the Solomons may include some damage already reported, but it's doubtful. One interesting thing does come out in the new report. That is the fact that the battleship is not a weapon of the past. Far from it. In that roaring gun battle on Saturday night, American battleships slugged it out with Japanese battleships for the first time in this war. It goes without saying, our gunners held their own, or did even better. Anyone who is worried about modern America getting soft, who is fearful that the old pioneer spirit of toughness had disappeared, might just as well forget about it. The battles in the Pacific and in Africa show that Americans are just as tough as they ever were. The spirit of John Paul Jones still rides the seas. Just when the furor over Admiral Darlan in North Africa seemed to have died out, it has cropped up again in a new guise. This time it concerns censorship. President Roosevelt, you'll remember, says our deal with Darlan, a Vichyite who has served the Nazis all along, is purely temporary. Wendell Willkie, it turns out now, was going to blast the Darlan deal in a speech last Monday. But Secretary of War Stimson persuaded him to drop all mention of Darlan. Mr. Willkie did criticize the State Department policy of the past 2 years with Vichy. It develops further that British correspondents here wanted to send the story abroad, the story that Mr. Willkie refrained from to outspoken criticism. Nevertheless, American censors held up their articles. And naturally, the British reporters are mad. The only thing that ought to be censored, they think, is military information. Political opinions here are something else again, they say, and Britain ought to be entitled to hear what American leaders are thinking. There has been trouble before on this, on the India independence question. The British reporters here have been forbidden by our censors before to cable stories dealing with American opinion on India. It seems the English newspaper men certainly have a point. And that's all from Washington.
You have been listening to the latest news, reported direct by NBC correspondents all over the world. We heard this morning from Edward Deuce in London, Grant Parr in Cairo, George Thomas Folster in Australia, Robert Magadoff in Moscow, and Kerry Longmire in Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company.